Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Kelly, for allowing us to come and talk with you about your involvement in the island's tourist industry. Could you just say for the tape, please, your name and your date of birth?
My name is Dolin Kelly, and I was born on the 8th of February, 1931.
Thank you. You were telling me just now that your mother got the family involved, perhaps more closely in tourism, when your father died, by starting the first ever snack bar in Port St Mary.
Well, it was the first snack bar in the Isle of Man, actually. The name was only coined in the 30s. We had a house which was right onto the sea. Our garden wall was a sea wall, and we had a gate from our grounds which went onto Chapel Beach in Port St Mary. And we had a pop stand down at that little gate, which we children, my sister, I was aged 7, my sister was aged 8, and my brother was aged 9 when my father died. Well, this took place a year later, 1939. And we looked after that pop stall. My mother had turned the greenhouse into a kitchen, and she did beach trays. And also my father's old study was a cafe. And yes, that was part of the involvement with the tourist trade. But my mother also bought 8 rowing boats, and she had 2 built, and they were operated from what's now the Carrick Bay steps, but which was in those days known as the Golf Links. The present Carrick Bay Hotel was then known as the Golf Links Hotel. Formerly, after it had been built, by the way, it had been called the Cliff Hotel. And we had the rowing boats operating from there. We also had a fishing boat, which was a bit of a disaster, really, because even in those days, fishermen were paid for when they didn't go to sea. And my mother didn't know enough about the fishing trade to know that the fishermen were able to keep the boat on shore and go and draw their dole when they weren't really entitled to it. But we also had a boat called the St. Mary, which did trips around the Calf of Man. We were involved, and we went into the haulage trade after that. And how that happened was that the war came, and of course straight away my mother knew that that was going to put the kibosh on future tourist trade for the next foreseeable few years. So we had a bit of land up at Fisted, and my brother and I had been sent away to the Royal Masonic Schools by this time. But she decided to turn it into a market garden. She had working for her an Irishman who'd come over to Thatcher Cottage, which we had infested, which I subsequently lived in, actually. And the Irishman was going to do all the digging and all the rest of it, and my mother would be the brains behind it. Well, she wanted this field manured, and so she hired a chap with a lorry called Gordon Madrill, who lived on the Truggan Road, and Gordon would bring up the rack and it was spread all over the field. But unfortunately, Gordon got a girl into trouble. She tried an abortion, she died, and Gordon tied a stone round his neck and threw himself over Port Erin Breakwater, port at the little pier. Now, I don't know, I was away off the island when this happened, but what I do know is that my mother said to the Irishman, Paddy, who had been looking after the boats and was going to dig the fields, she said to him, "You know, Murray," because she always called everybody, all servants by their surname, of course, "you know, Murray, I'm thinking there'll be a cheap lorry going there." That was her response to Gordon's suicide, because she still needed the fields to be manured. "Sure, ma'am," he said, "and hasn't it got cattle rails as well?" And she said, "What on earth are cattle rails?" And he explained to her that you can turn an ordinary lorry into a cattle lorry. Now, Gordon had been at Ballasalla Mart on the Tuesday, and the next Tuesday my mother was there. There was no break in this continuity at all, and that's how she got into the haulage trade. And she did that all through the war and right up to my leaving school. It was only when I went in the army in 1950 that the business collapsed. Because
she sounds like a very enterprising woman. I believe she was a mechanic as well.
Yes, she was. I think that must have been about 1917. She came from a moneyed family. My grandfather was, I once said to my mother, "What did Granny Powers, we called him, what did he do for a living?" do, she said. He didn't do anything. He was a gentleman. And I said, well, how come he let you be a mechanic? I should really tell you that she, prior to this, she had worked in government office in the days of the governor being, most of these jobs being in the say-so of the governor, but the indoor life had not suited her. She'd been at finishing school in Switzerland. She came home, and it would be, I can't think of the governor at the moment. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Raglan, Lord Raglan. And when somebody with the grand title of registrar went off to the war, he said, who can we have as registrar? Oh, I know, we'll ask Kathleen Grange. Well, she didn't survive very long there because her health wasn't too good. And so she then went on munitions down at King William's College, or vice versa. Maybe that came first, I don't know. But she then went to this motor mechanicing business, and I said to her, how on earth did Granny Pa let you do a job like that? Phew, she said, he was too mean. She'd never remembered a time. She was born in 1896, but she never remembered a time when they hadn't had a motor car. So that shows you how keen he was on gadgets and things. And she said he saw a cheap way of having the car looked after.
Well, thanks very much for a bit of family background about your extremely interesting family. Can you tell me a bit about how you yourself came to get involved in the island's tourist industry?
Yeah. Well, it was when I was at college. I went there in 1953, and I wanted a job. I'd been hawking herrings prior to going there, and there wasn't any money in that. And so I thought I would fancy driving a coach. So I came home for that, because it was only 2 years teacher training in those days. Came home in the 1954. Straight away applied for my driving test. And I went round looking for a job. And I found a chap called Norman Crellin, who ran a firm called Douglas Motors. The firm consisted of one Austin taxi and one 26-seater Bedford coach. And I said, I understand you're looking for a driver. He said, yes, I am. I said, well, I haven't got a license, but I'm down for a test on Monday or whatever day it was. And so he said, well, that's fine. He said, if you don't pass your test, you can drive the taxi and I'll drive the coach. So I duly turned up with the coach, passed my test, and he had a whole load of people waiting for me that very morning, because I was tested quite early in the morning. Straight away off and went round. In those days, you used to go round the houses picking up your people from the houses. I can tell you more about that later. And we picked these people. I mean, he said, would your mother, and my mother had gone up with me to take the test because she had an all groups license. And Norman, the boss, was too busy going around getting bookings at that time. So he said to my mother, would you like to go around the island with Dolan? So she said, oh, yes, that would be nice. And so I had her sitting in the front seat alongside me. And as we were going along, I would be saying, oh, this is Snaefell and this is Barul and this is this place, and telling them a story about this place and that place. And every so often I'd say to my mother, that's right, isn't it? And she'd say, yes, or well, actually, it's so-and-so. And when we got back, of course, he was very anxious to see how the new driver had got on. So he opened the door and he said to the people, how was it? Did you enjoy the trip? And, oh, yes, but I did feel sorry for that driver. There was this old woman sitting up by him and telling him what, you know.
So. Can you tell me a bit about, you mentioned getting bookings and going around the hotels to raise the business?
Well, it's very different today. For one, it's probably mainly local trade, but now there are booking offices, and yeah, they go to the booking office. There were booking offices then, I might tell you, and the big and biggest and best and most successful firms had booking offices. But I could just tell you that there used to be, on a Thursday night at Castletown, alternate Thursdays, there was a ladies' football match, and the other Thursday, it would be a motorcycle gymkhana, organised by ex-inspector Fred Farraker of the police. Well, he was still inspector Fred Farraker, and it was for Castletown Football Club. And one time, one of the drivers decided to go around and count how many coaches were there. And there were 110 coaches down at that one function. Now, today, it is just past belief that there were ever that number of coaches on the island. Of course, some of them were 20-seaters, 22-seaters, 26-seaters, and the biggest at that time that he made that count was a 32-seater. But there were lots of these coaches and lots of little firms with just one coach, some two, three, four, and so on. And also there were things which you haven't got left anymore, I don't think. There might possibly be one down up on Colonel's Road by the War Memorial in Douglas, and that is Hackney Stands. And the coaches, all along Douglas Promenade, there were spaces marked off for Hackney Stands. And the way a Hackney Stand worked was that there was an official card given you by Douglas Corporation, given the boss, every Sunday, and the week started on a Sunday, and it explained that if there were four on the stand, then you were number three, say, on the Sunday, you would be number two on the next day, and number one on the next day, and then you go back to four. Now, the Colonel's Road stand had about 20-odd. There were only ever six on the stand at once, and the rest were queuing behind the Gaiety Theatre. The stand I was on, which I think was called the Empress Stand, it was a little bit Summerland side. Summerland wasn't built then, but a little bit Summerland side of the Crescent Cinema, but on the opposite side of the road. But we had four there. Now, you then had to take potluck. You had to try to get the people, entice the people into your coach. The Douglas Corporation had paid inspectors going round so that you were not allowed to tout. Touting was an offence. Of course, we did tout. I hated it. I didn't mind trying to talk to people and talk them into a thing, but to actually tout when I knew it was against the law, with sort of mumbling away to the people and at the same time keeping an eye open for an inspector, didn't actually suit me. But it was very difficult to fill a coach. Also, it was very difficult to forecast what time your coach would leave. So you would just put that you were going round the island, and they would say, what time you're going round the island? Well, mumble, 10 o'clock, you know. But you mightn't get off till 10:30, because the truth was, you went when you got a full load, or as near a full load as possible. And so what had started before I started driving was that the bosses would go round to landladies in the winter and sort of sign the landladies up so that we could actually go in and talk to the people over the breakfast, and most of our bookings came that way. Now, my boss was only a very small firm, and our houses were all what now they consider residential areas, up Selburn Drive, Selburn Road, Westminster Terrace, there above the museum, Richmond Grove above the museum, all around that area, where maybe the houses would take no more than half a dozen people in. And you had to try to get round these in the morning to see whether people wanted to go around the island. If you didn't get off round the island and you maybe go on a morning tour to Port Sodwick or somewhere off the stand, because you'd have stand people as well, then Norman, because I was as green as grass first year, didn't know any different. He'd say, right, round the houses again at lunchtime, because they did, most of the people booked in for full board. So you'd go round at lunchtime, and then again at tea time. You didn't have time to eat. You didn't have time. You're absolutely worn to a frazzle, but there was no other way of getting people. You had to get the backsides on the seats, and that was up to the driver. And a driver was judged to be a good driver who could load a coach. Fortunately, I could load a coach.
What was the trick of getting them on? The best things you learned over the...
Well, I don't know. I've got to remember I was a lot younger. So there's one thing I learned pretty quickly, that it was very easy to get girls onto coaches, but it was a heck of a hard job to get fellas onto coaches. They wanted just the booze. But the girls were trying to get off with the driver, so it was really quite easy. But I would go jump on a few years. I went to work for a chap called George Wharton, who had Highlander coaches. Now, Highlander, although it wasn't the biggest firm, was probably the most successful firm. In those days, round the island cost 8 shillings.
What year, maybe?
Well, I started in 54, so, and I think that all the time that I was driving, I drove for 13 years, I don't think it ever went beyond that. It was 8 shillings. There were people who undercut that price. That was, by the way, was an agreed price by the Coach Owners Association. But where Highlander was so successful, we did what was called the Extended Round the Island Tour. Now, the normal Round the Island Tour went from, I'll describe it south about, but some went north about, went Douglas, Rushen Abbey, Port Erin, Peel, Ramsey, back to Douglas. But our tour, for which we charged 10 bob, that's 2 shillings more, okay, 10 bob us against 8 shillings, ours went from Douglas, Rushen Abbey, Port Erin, and of course you drove through Port St Mary, Peel, and then instead of going from Peel to Ramsey, we went Peel, Point of Ayr, then Ramsey, okay? Wait a minute. So that was another selling point, and we had a good booking office. But we had a fellow come to work for us at Highlander Coaches after I'd been there a year or two. Must say, I was teaching all this time. I just did it during TT week and school holidays, you see. And that chap was Jack Edmonds, who later became an MHK. Very much a live wire. He's still around. He was driving a taxi until recently. And Jack, he went to jail, did Jack, while he was an MHK for receiving, which was great hard luck, because I thought he would have bounced back, but he never really did bounce back. But anyway, I was reckoned to be a pretty good driver. I could always sail, as we called it. I always went, because I always managed to book myself at least half a load, plus whatever you got from the office. And if you had half a load, the boss would not turn yours off to go on to somebody who'd only got a quarter load. He would take the ones from the person who got a quarter load and put them onto your coach. So I was always pretty good at getting at least half a load, but usually three quarters of a load. And I was beginning to pat myself on the back a bit and think I was quite clever. Till Jack hit the scene. And Jack would load not just his own coach, but half another coach. He could always load 1.5 to 2 coaches. So I was never proud in these matters. And I said to him one day, "Jack, how the devil do you do it?" He said, "It's easy," he said. "I don't ask them. I tell them." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, when I'm going round the houses," he said, "I tell them Wednesday's the day they go round the island from this house, or from Tuesday or whatever it was." And then I said, "I don't take a single booking. I just turn up." And they were like lambs to the slaughter. They get on the coach. So for the rest of that season, I tried that, and blow me, it worked. And so I was getting a coach and a half, I beg your pardon. But when I went back the following year, I hadn't a bottle anymore, and I'm very glad I hadn't, because I think that was totally dishonest. But there we are. So how do you do them? You did them by any way you could. When we were still on the stand and I was working for Norman Crellin, he would walk behind me. "Do you want to go to Rushen Abbey? Rushen Abbey, we're going tonight. Nice night at Rushen Abbey." Mumble, you know, orchestra, strawberries and cream. He'd be mumbling all this way, right the way from our stand as far as the next stand down the promenade. And the people would be turning round and calling for everything, but he wouldn't give up. Well, I couldn't do that and wouldn't do that. But going back to the stand, if you're interested, I told you that we couldn't be sure what time we'd go, and obviously you put yourself into the people's shoes, you want to know what time you're going. So it'd be after lunch maybe, and you'd be doing an afternoon trip maybe to Port Erin. That's another thing they used to do when I started: Port Erin and Rushen Abbey in the afternoon. It was a rush to stop at Rushen Abbey and stop at Port Erin, but it was a legacy from just immediately after the war, when just to drive was a novelty for the people, because there'd be no petrol or anything like that during the war. And I actually spotted that things were changing, and that people actually wanted to go somewhere and see the place. They didn't want to drive around. And I actually started the Port Erin only, and I called it Express Guaranteed 1.5 hours stop. and we filled the coaches, no problem at all. But that was when I was with Highlander. But getting back to what I was saying, which was being on the stand, one day, why I got the job in the first place with Norman Crallin was because my coach was called the Mona's Queen. And it was the only one, I think, in the Isle of Man which had the door at the back. All the other coaches had the entrance at the front, and no other driver would drive it. Because, of course, you had to, the thing is that when you get out of the door before the passengers, so your hand is there to get the tips. And I drove it because I was very nimble on my feet. I didn't dash down the line and push down the aisle and push them out of the way to get to the back door. I jumped out through the emergency door, which was on my side, on the driver's side. And all those passengers who were scrambling to get out without giving you a tip, I'm afraid, never beat me to it. I was around there and I had opened the door and said, "Hope you enjoyed your trip, madam," or whatever it was. Anyway, this...
Would they give you quite good tips?
Or? Oh, yes, yes. I often wondered, the half crown was still in when I was driving, and I often wondered that first year when the half crown went out, how it affected the coach drivers, because I bet people went down to giving them just 2 shillings, you know. But, oh, no, you did very, very well on tips. However, I remember this particular day, we were loading for an afternoon trip to wherever it was, and Norman was saying, "How many you got in there? How many?" And I said, "There's 8 in there, you know." And the people would be saying, "When are we going, driver? When are we going, driver?" And then the next thing, "How many have you got in there?" "Oh, well, there's 10 in there now, you know." And it's going on like this. And I was positioned at the back door, okay, to stop them walking out. You see, because they were getting so fratchy, and this was routine, and one of the reasons I hated stand work. Anyway, I said, "We better go now, Norman." It was 26 seater, and we were up to about 20 people. I said, "With these people in waiting." "No, no, no, no." He was as mean as hell in that way. I mean, I liked the guy, but anyway, he said, "No, I'll try for a few more." So then he said a minute later, "How many do you say you've got?" And I looked in. I'd got about 3, and all the others had walked out through the emergency door. They were unbeknownst to me. They'd got into the seat of the coach in front, which was going somewhere entirely different. There they were on the back seat waving to me as it pulled away because it had just filled the other coach. So I said, "Well, I hope you've learned your lesson from that," because we had to get rid of those 3. Of course, we couldn't sail with 3.
What were the favourite places that visitors used to like to go to?
I wouldn't know, really. I suppose Russian Abbey had to be the favourite, I suppose, because they always had a very pleasant little 3-piece dance band there. They had this very good dance floor, which was walled on 3 sides only. So it was open air, in effect, and it had a glass roof, so there was plenty of light. It was a light building, and strawberries and cream were the great delicacy, of course, and there was a waitress service, so you could get tea and coffee and all the rest of it. I suppose that was the favourite. There were places which they went to, which was almost a racket taking them there, really. The other destinations were, for instance, on a Sunday, people always went to Kirkbraddon to the open-air church service in the morning, thousands and thousands, and some coaches did 3 journeys there. The most I ever did was 2. I like to do only 1 because the church service on a Kirkbraddon was your chance to get your people for the week. You got the people in the coach, and you took them for a drive after the church service. And you pointed out a few bits of the things in Douglas and put your own personality over so they knew then whether they could get on with you or not. And I always saw them, by the way, not as my friends, but as my enemies. I was determined that those people would get on that coach and would not get off without they tipped me. So they didn't realise. They thought, "Oh, this lovely, charming fellow." But I was actually fighting a battle with them the whole time. So Sunday was morning was very important because you put your personality over, and you took bookings then. You say, well, what day would you like to go around the island? Okay, well, Wednesday, whatever day would suit you, and so on. So you started your book on a Sunday morning. Sunday afternoon, every single coach in the Isle of Man, or every single coach from Douglas, for some reason, because it was traditional, went to Glenmire and to Niarbal and Glenmire. And I used to think it was a bit of a dead sort of a trip. There was a cafe at Niarbal, and I always thought, well, you know, that's what we're taking them for, a cup of tea. Then 20 minutes later, or 10 minutes later, rather, you were at Glenmire and another cup of tea. And there wasn't time to see these places. I mean, Niarbal and Glenmire, both nice places, but not when you say be back in 20 minutes sort of thing. So those were two destinations. Glen Helen was beginning to die on its feet by the time I started. Donald Lowy had it at the time. He tried all sorts of gimmicks. He put a bit of a zoo there, which I think he called it a zoo, but I think it was, if I remember rightly, it was one monkey in a cage. They'd built a ballroom just after the war there, and they had Crazy Night, they called it. I can't remember what they did at Crazy Night now.
Have been all that crazy.
No. We didn't, generally speaking, go in and share the delights of the place with the customers. But there was, wherever you went, for the drivers, by the way, this is not answering your question, but I haven't up to now so far, so why should I break the habit? There was always a driver's room, and you got a cup of tea, a sandwich. They always really looked after the drivers wherever you went well. And there would be dropsy, as we called it. That was half a crown, you know, for the driver.
Would you have to pay for your cup of tea and sandwich?
No. They gave you that, and they also gave you half a crown as well, you see, for taking the people there. So getting back to the other destinations, there was, of course, round the island. I mentioned the places you go to there. And again, going to the dropsy thing, we would ring from wherever our previous call was, Port Erin or Ramsey, depending which way we're going around the island, through to a cafe, which was arranged. Oh, yes. Well, we'd ring ahead to the cafe that our boss had arranged with. Some drivers actually did it by their own arrangement, but I always went where the boss told me to go. And you would say, there's so many for dinner today. Well, you got your dinner, which was the same all over Peel, which was tomato soup, beef and two veg, roast potatoes, mashed potatoes, and pudding and custard. And I think they probably paid extra for tea or coffee. There was one difference to that. One of the places would give you the choice. Lamb was more expensive than beef in those days, so you could actually have a choice of lamb or beef. Actually, it was the same meat, but you had mince sauce with they called it lamb. And you also not only got your dinner in a driver's room, but you got dropsy. You got 5 bob as well for the passengers. Now, talking about destinations, if there was something special on, like a special night at Laxey or something like that, obviously they would go on. I told you earlier on about the ladies' football and the motorcycle gymkhanas. But my two favourite runs, really, was on a Friday afternoon. Again, tradition. Don't know why we didn't do it the rest of the week. But you did Port St Mary and the Calf of Man and Craig Naish. And I got into awful trouble there with one of the drivers, a chap called Strawberry Stoley, still around. Because, of course, when I'd been in the agricultural haulage up here in Craig Naish, all the farmers on the Mull Peninsula were customers of ours. So I had driven a cattle wagon down to Harry Kelly's cottage and loaded there at Harry Kelly's cottage. There were 3 farms in Craig Naish which I used to lift stock from many and many a time. So when I started on this trip, I took the coach down to Harry Kelly's cottage, right to Harry Kelly's cottage. I mean, it's a damn good job nobody else decided to do the same, because we couldn't, you know, had a traffic jam. The others always used to park at the top, but I took my people right down to the door. Anyway, the particular day, I drive up afterwards, and when I go to get out, there's a big brand new coach stuck across the road at the top, and I couldn't get out. So I jumped into this coach, and I moved it, and then off down to the Sound, which is a beautiful spot to take people. And the cafe hasn't changed all that much, but it was a lovely spot to take people. Well, I was in this tiny little driver's room there, and suddenly the door bursts open, and this big booming voice, "Did you move my coach?" I said, "Yes, I did." He said, "Nobody," he said, "nobody drives that coach but me. My life savings are in that coach." I told him it was brand new, you see, he said. "And nobody drives." Well, I said, "Don't park it there." I said, "Otherwise it'll be moved next week. And don't bother about the key," because I said, "I can start it without a key. So just don't damn well leave it there." But Strawberry and I got on very, very well afterwards, funny enough, because I stood up to him.
Was there a good camaraderie among the drivers? Because you must have got to know each other in the driver's room.
Yeah, there was a great camaraderie. And there was also, you know, it was just a hotbed of gossip like any other community. Did you hear this? Did you hear that? And yes, I won't tell you about all the conversations that we had, yes, but there was. I was a little bit resented by one or two because I came in at the peak of the season and was able to take the cream. But then the drivers were needed, and the trade needed people like me who would only come in during those peak weeks. But there were always people talking about the union, and they ought to get the union onto it, because I think there were probably about three or four drivers who belonged to the union, but I will